The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Thanks for coming tonight. I think you're going to agree when we're complete here that it's well worth it, and there's a very valuable lesson in all of this that we'll go through this evening. Last time we went over Daniel 2, when Daniel was raised in position and status. So God's servant was raised to almost second. That is, he was the man who stood in the gate for the king. And standing in the gate always represented the one who you went to for counselor. So he was his chief counselor after this. So anyway, God then began to make himself known for the first time in the kingdom of Babylon. Now he reveals himself as a God who has the power to deliver men. And in this case, in chapter 3, he delivers these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, from the fate of a fiery furnace. And it's an interesting chapter in this respect. It appears to be written by Daniel, and yet we don't see Daniel anywhere in this story. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Where was he? Why don't we hear from Daniel here? Didn't he have to bow down here when the music played? What was going on? Well, a couple possibilities, I think, are this. It's very likely that Daniel himself was absent from Babylon at this time. He may have been overseas on official business because he was very high in the king's court. Number two, he could have been in a closed session with other magistrates regarding important business, that's possible, legislative business regarding the empire. It could have been this, that Daniel's position was so high that he was not required to show his loyalty in this particular way. That is, the king Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't have to bow down, did he, and worship the image. And it's very likely that the persons or individuals standing next to him would not have had to have bowed down as well. It was basically the people were pulled in from various provinces. They were leaders from provinces that were outside of Babylon. And the men over the provinces that were Jewish were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then the other people that came in were leaders and governors and so on, magistrates from other provinces in the territories. Now, I say this, too, as a possibility. It may have been that God's hand was in this from the beginning to keep Daniel out of this, because Daniel was the main servant of God in the palace, but there were other faithful believers there too. And it could be that God tested Daniel, as you remember, and he tests him in other places as we go through other chapters here. But would he not want to test these other men to see if they were faithful as well, without Daniel there, perhaps to protect him? Because Daniel could have warned the king and said, hey, this won't fly here, you know, could take another route, something like that. And I say this because, as you remember, in the times of Jesus, in the New Testament was written, in the time of the church, Rome had strict laws. You had to worship their gods. You had to worship the emperor, except the Jews were accepted, because everybody knew they wouldn't do it. So you just weren't going to kill a whole nation of people, you see. And so there are times, let me put it that way, where people have been accepted from these kinds of rulings. So anyway, down through history. So it's an idea that God may have removed Daniel for some reason so that these men would stand alone, because he was going to test them. Now the time setting here is about 17 or 19 years after the dream had occurred. Nebuchadnezzar had just returned from the Jewish and Syrian wars. He was deeply grateful for the success that he believed his God had given him. And as you remember, he was this head of gold. He was the beginning of a vast empire that was going to be growing. And so he was very successful in his wars. But he was also coming back filled with spoil from all of these nations. He had destroyed and taken their gold, and he was then able to lavish this on this great image. And with that, we start in chapter 3 and verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof was 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And so he made an image here that was extremely high. It was 60 cubits by 6 And the first thing to notice, I think, about this is that 60 and 6 are multiples of what? The number 6. And the number 6, of course, is the number of a man. And I think one of the most obvious penchants of man is that he's idolatrous, that he builds idols, that he is someone who worships these kinds of man-made gods. And so it's, to me, appropriate just to see the numbers in here. A second, I think, point of interest is simply the proportions here. That is, it's a 1 to 10 proportion here. And an image that was approximately 90 feet high by 20 feet wide. Now, the normal human proportion is 6 to 1. And so some scholars, of course, the critics of the Bible, reject this chapter, and they say this is all ridiculous. There wouldn't be an image that was a 10 to 1 proportion. But I think we can look at this in a pretty obvious way that in all likelihood, the image itself sat on top of a pillar. And so the whole thing would be 90 feet, but in all likelihood, it sat on a 30-foot pillar, and you got 60 feet, more or less, rising up of image on top of a pillar. And another reason they reject this is that there's all the gold. In other words, some people think that what is meant here is that it was solid gold, and of course that's ridiculous. And Isaiah talks about how the idols are made, and they made them out of wood in most cases, and brick they would do. Make them out of wood and brick, and then they would overlay them with gold. And in the case of the Ambassador College, I don't know how many had ever seen this auditorium that was built there. The stairs were covered with gold. It was actual gold. But it's beaten so thin, so incredibly thin, that it's just like a layer of very thin paint. And that's what they did here in this case. And so the image was not solid gold at all, but was rather overlaid with gold. Now, it was constructed in the plain of Dura, and the location of Dura is not known today, but it was not inside the city or inside the temple. I mean, it was a large area that was selected, and the scholars and so on suggested it was located probably by the Euphrates River there in a plain just outside the city. An area that would be one in which it would make such a image highly conspicuous, and also an area where a large number of people could collect themselves. Now, it seems to me that there's a statement in our society today that is appropriate to use, and that's this: unclear on the concept. Have you heard that statement? When somebody's just totally unclear on the concept, it just goes right over their head. And I think that's the case of Nebuchadnezzar here, that I think it's clear that he just didn't get it. He had this dream of an image. And in the interpretation, Nebuchadnezzar was this head of gold. And so he's going, yes, you know, yes, that's me. That's my kingdom. And so I think he was at least in part trying to fulfill the typology here of the dream of the image. And I think it was vanity. And I think he just didn't realize God gave him the dream, not to show him how great he was, but to show him that God was great, and that he was the one that sets up kings, and that all of these nations would eventually be destroyed, and so on. Anyway, the statue may not have been, as some suggest, that it was a statue actually of King Nebuchadnezzar. I think that would have been stated in Scripture. But in all likelihood, to demand worship, it would have been perhaps the god Baal that was a golden image that represented the nation, or it could have even been his father. Sometimes in these pagan beginning civilizations, what they did was they would worship as a god the father of the king, and that represented then to them the nation as a total. But anyway, he missed the point in all of this. And then this image... No image that was made in those days could be accepted as an object of worship until it had been dedicated. And so there was then this event that was the dedication of this image. So from time immemorial after this, the image could be looked at as an object of worship, but not until then. So he calls all his nobles, all of his officers from all the captive lands back to Babylon for this ceremony. Daniel 3 and verse 2. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, and the judges, and the treasurers, and the counselors, and the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. I want you to consider this for a moment from the king's standpoint. No reasonable man would refuse to show, at least in that day, their loyalty to the government or to its God. And in this time period, why, it was the recent establishment of a brand new nation that was a world-ruling power. Assyria had fallen, and Babylon had now become the single most powerful nation in the entire world. And for this reason, the king would think this is appropriate for this ceremony, that he would bring all of these people who were the leaders of all the conquered lands in, and representatives from all the countries and all the provinces and all the languages would come, and this to them would then be a solemn oath of loyalty to the God of the nation who was the nation that they were subject to. And so they were all gathered to this one event here in verse 3. The princes, the governors, captains, and judges, and treasurers, and counselors, and sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together under the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And I think one of the things that this shows to me is the incredible organization of the governmental system there, don't you? That they had a hierarchy of all kinds of levels of rulers, and it would just bore you to tears if I went through each one of these, of course, but they were different levels all the way down to law officers and so on in the different areas. Now, one of the things that's of interest here that I'll just pass on is that most of the commentaries agree to this, that some of these words, the sheriffs and the rulers and the counselors and the governors, some of the Chaldean words for these were lost to history by the 200s. Now, I say this as an important point, and it's for this reason, that some of the critics of the Bible, as you remember from last time, suggest that all of this was written later in the 200s, when the Maccabeans were in power, when the Greek kingdom was ruling, and they say that this was written far later, and that would account for the accuracy of the prophecies, you see, instead of believing that God had inspired these things. And so what we see here is by the time the 200s came, some of these words were lost to history. And some of the Jews in Alexandria could not translate some of this at that time because they didn't know what these words meant. And so the point is, why? Because it had been written hundreds of years before that, right when it said it was, around about 530 is when it was, B.C. So anyway, kings assembled then a vast orchestra to play for this event, and the announcement is made in verse 4 through 6. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people and nations and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whosoever falls not down to worship shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." And so the orchestra played, and when it did, it was a sign to bow and worship. And every official in every nation had to bow in obeisance here. And those who wouldn't be would be thrown into this burning fiery furnace. This furnace would have already been burning. And that's why you understand this whole thing was very political. He was showing, I am in control of all this land, and you will show your loyalty to me and the God I worship. So he would have had this furnace already burning, and as the officials came by, you see, they'd see that, and they'd know this is the fate. And so it was a grim reminder of the fate who would not be loyal. Now, only the Hebrews would be the only ones who would even consider objecting to something like this. All the people of all the lands during this period of time were used to worshiping idols. They just all did it. And the idea of worshiping another god from your own god, well, there was nothing thought wrong with this. In fact, it was believed primarily that each land had its own god, and each peoples had their own god. And so if you went to another land, there was nothing wrong with worshiping the god of that land. And so it never seemed to take away from any god to worship another. And it was appropriate, deemed appropriate, to worship the god of those that had conquered you. So when the music struck, there was then universal compliance. Daniel 3 and verse 7. Therefore, at that time, all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, and the psaltery, and all kinds of music. All the people, the nations, and the languages, they all fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. At that very moment that the music started, every forehead touched the ground. Every head bowed, all of them except three: Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I'm sure the rest of the officials there just stared in absolute disbelief. How could these three be so foolish? They had coveted positions right in the palace, in the court. And now these positions were at stake. In fact, their very lives hung in the balance of this. Why would they risk this for some eccentric religious belief? You can imagine how they would look upon these three guys. What is going on? And of course, there were those who in the court would have been jealous of these people, and because they had risen to positions that were over them. And so they would use stealth and guile, as it were, to rid the palace of those that had superior ability to themselves. So some of the priestly line, went to complain to the king. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans, remember the Chaldeans were the high priests there, the highest status in the wise men, they came near and accused the Jews, and they spoke and they said, O King Nebuchadnezzar, O King, live forever. You, O King, have made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And those that fall not down and worship, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Well, there are certain Jews whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O King, have not regarded you. They serve not your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. And so the priests here now repeat the words of the king exactly in its entirety. Now, of course, they do this to feign a sort of zeal for the king. And it's primarily to ingratiate themselves to the king. And I want you to think just for a minute about this. These were the same men who had been earlier saved by Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. Their prayers and their fastings are what resulted in God giving the interpretation of the dream. And it saved their lives. And this happens from time to time. If you remember the case of Jeremiah, I don't know if you remember this or not, but he had prayed that certain peoples would be saved and not die. And those very peoples turned on him. They dug a pit, and they threw him in that pit in order to hopefully kill him. Remember this, Cain and Abel. You remember what happened? Abel's sacrifice was accepted, and Cain was angry. This is the same thing. You've got people that have superior ability. They come in the court, and now they make you look a little foolish, or maybe your job or your status or power or authority in the palace is now threatened. So what do? You get rid of them, of course. You know, this is what goes on in corporate America all the time. It's the same thing. So anyway, what happens is people will do evil to repay good when we are a threat to them. And these individuals, like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, had eclipsed these other so-called wise men, and so they felt threatened. And this is what will happen, and you'll see this in human nature over and over again. Now, when it says in here, certain Jews, this is particularly a derogatory form. It's a comment that's derogatory, showing disdain for their nationality and for their religion. And these people, Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, were from what was considered a despised nation. And so they were thinking, this is insolent that they wouldn't be grateful for what the king's done, raising them in station and capacity in their nation. Now, when it says this, that they have not regarded you, it would be better said this way, that they paid no attention to you. You see, the priests were trying to rub salt into the wound. These guys don't respect you. They could care less what you say, King. In other words, the strategy worked well, as it often does. The king is now enraged. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. The word rage is regus in the Chaldean. It means violent anger. Fury is chema and means hot displeasure and indignation. Now, it's anger with a desire to do violence because of being indignant. And I remind us of this. This is another example of human nature in action. The thought is that someone would not obey your command. You understand what the issue is? Because it's your command. That's why the person gets enraged. And so a person today will go into uncontrollable rage if you don't do what they say to do. I want you to think about this in terms of the God we serve and the kind of character that we're to build here. We break God's commands all the time, don't we? And he's a great and majestic king. Does he go into a rage over it? Does he threaten to do us harm because we break his commands? No. No, God doesn't want us to break his commands. Why? Because those commandments are for our good. They're like walls that we're not to cross over, to keep us going down the right path. And if we break his commands, then there's a kickback. We suffer for it. We get hurt because of it. And so God's concern about his commands are that we obey them so that our life goes well, as he says, so that it might be well with you and your generations, so that we'll be successful in life, so we'll be happy and we won't suffer the kickbacks. But you understand the difference here? Human nature says, you don't obey my command, you die. You know, and God says, you don't obey my command and you have to die because, you know, it's the wrong way of life and so on. But he doesn't want us to break his commands because it's going to hurt us. And that's his whole issue. So it's so different, God's nature and human nature. But anyway, the response from this king was all these officials could have ever hoped for. The king furiously orders these guys be brought to him. And then he asks them, did you really not bow down? Verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, and he said of them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do you not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I've set up? So here it is. He's saying the words, is it true? And I think this has a little different meaning than we would tend to think of it. It's more like this. Is this on purpose? That's what he's really saying here. Did you do this on purpose? Or like, was it a misunderstanding, is what he's saying here. The king probably stared at these guys incredulously. How could you do this? You've always shown loyal to me before. What's going on here? It must be a mistake. So the king has a little bit of conscience here, and he says, hey, I respect these people. I know them. I know what they've done in the past. He gives them another chance, verse 15. And he says this, now, if you be ready, that what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, if you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast that same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Uh-oh. You can see us right now. But you understand, here again, Nebuchadnezzar had not really learned the lesson of the dream. He had given God lip service. Yeah, you're pretty significant here, God. You can interpret dreams and so on. And he had said that God was a God of gods, and he was a Lord of lords. But he should have realized that these were the servants of that same God, and he should not harm or think to harm the servants of this God. But he really didn't think that this God, who could interpret dreams, could deliver these men from this punishment. And I don't know if you remember the story, but about 100 years before this, the Assyrian king, that was the greatest power then, came down and took Israel captive, because that was within God's plan that they were being punished for their disobedience. At that time, the Jews had not disobeyed. Sennacherib came down to them and he said, you better give yourselves up to me. And he said, every other nation, there isn't one God of those nations that could deliver any of those people out of my hand. And your God, he can't deliver you out of my hand either. And that's another uh-oh. Because the next thing he knew, he woke up in the morning, and God had confused and put fear in his army, and they got up and they killed each other. and he lost his entire army. And I'll suggest this. 100 years before this, the seeds were sown for Babylon to take control because Assyria was so weakened by this defeat. But you understand, this is the way these people thought. And rightly so, in one sense, you understand. They didn't know the true God, that this God is different. They just thought these gods of the lands that they worshipped and the demigods that followed under them and so on, that were a little weaker and so on, they could get help from them. But they didn't understand a God who intervened in the lives of men and women and that could do anything and that nothing was impossible. And this pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar, could never have known the love and the kind of loyalty generated in the hearts of men by the true God. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego love God more than they love their lives. And they put their trust in this God, so much so they didn't even plead to make an exception in their case. Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered, and they said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer you in this matter. Now, this saying, we're not careful to answer you, infers something. First, I think it infers this, that they conferred with one another and they came prepared with a common answer. They spoke in unison here. Now, careful to answer you is of also interest in another respect. Literally means we have no need to answer you. In other words, we're fixed on our path. You're fixed on your path. You understand? There's no use arguing about this, Nebuchadnezzar, is what they're saying. And I think they say this, and I think there's a point well taken here, and that is this: hesitation or negotiation all serves to weaken our resolve. When it comes to temptations regarding obeying God or sinning, not hesitating decision is the only way to approach these things, the only safe way. We've got our mind made up in advance. There is no alternative, no negotiation. We're not going to talk about this, see? We're not going to try and negotiate or try to parlay this into something. So they weren't timid in answering the king. They wouldn't soft-pedal their answer. They wouldn't hold anything back, and they weren't going to couch their answer in any kind of politics. And this example, I think, is worth considering. And I say for this reason, the people of God, we fall into ditches. We often take two separate extremes when we deal with outsiders in this. That is, too many, I think, Christians today are really over-concerned with what others think. And peer pressure is not just a teenage problem. That is, we care very much what other people think about us, how we dress, how we look, what kind of financial level we're in, what kind of economic status, what kind of car we drive. This means so much to people in our society, and it rubs off on Christians. And there's a certain pride associated with this, that we're caring so much about what others think about us. But you understand, this threatens our spirituality when we do this. We tend to end up acting on someone else's value system, not God's. And this is where it can become dangerous. It threatens our spiritual health. We don't have to have, and we will not have, everyone agreeing with us. We're not going to be liked by everybody. You might as well understand that right up front. And so we should be concerned with what God thinks and not what men thinks, or what man thinks. Now, there's a story of Frederick the Great, I think, that illustrates this pretty well. Sometimes we, in our life, want to be a little political. We don't want to say what we really believe. We'd rather just kind of keep silent and keep in the background. Anyway, Frederick the Great's most famous general was a man named von Zeeland. And Frederick the Great, he cared nothing at all for Christianity. And one day he was making comments and laughing and mocking Jesus Christ. He was blaspheming and swearing. And every one of the generals around him and all of his aides and officials were all laughing and just going along with this. But it was too much for Zeeland. And here's what he said to Frederick the Great. Sir, you know I fought for you in 38 battles and won them all. I'm an old man now, and I'm soon going to have to go to the presence of one greater than you, the Lord Jesus Christ, of whom you are blaspheming. My king, I cannot stand to hear my Savior spoken in this manner. I love Jesus Christ. Please do not misuse his name. And Frederick the great as he was, with a trembling voice replied, I beg your pardon, General Zeeland. And you understand the point. There's times when we're afraid to speak up. And yet, you know, if your boss is really using God's name in vain, are you willing to say, hey, I mean, how does it affect you? How do you feel about that? Are you willing to say, hey, stops here. You know, I'm not going to do that. Are we willing to say what we really believe and take a stand that way? Now, on the other hand, I want to say this. There's a time and a place for everything. Because some will take this example of these young boys here that are no longer boys, by the way, because it's 17 to 19 years afterwards. But these young men, they take this example, and then I've seen people that are Christians just be brazen about their beliefs where they need not be. That is, they'll go to potential employers and say, I keep the Sabbath, deal with it. You know, well, you don't need to do this. You understand my point here, that instead of using some caution and thinking before they speak. So let's go over to Colossians 4, if you will, for a minute. If an employer were to tell you and me, if you don't work on the Sabbath, you're going to be fired, that's a time to do what? Take a stand. Make it clear. Tell them you're going to lose a very good employee if you want to take that approach. For applying for a job, it's a whole different scenario, isn't it? We're not being faced with an ultimatum. And so Colossians 4 in verse 5 and 6, Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6, gives us what I believe is some very, very good advice. And where it says this, walk in wisdom towards them that are without, redeeming the time. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. And so there's a difference here, isn't there? There's a time and there's a place when you want to be bold, and there's a time where you might not need to or shouldn't be bold. But the Christian should speak with wisdom towards those who are outside. Sometimes you'll see Christians speaking like they're superior. Sometimes you see Christians that say they believe in God's way, and yet they're always confronting everybody, always trying to push themselves on everybody and get some kind of an argument going, you see, so that they can tell them how smart they are and how righteous they are and that kind of thing. This is not good. It's not good. When we're in conversations, we should think before we speak, and especially when dealing with those that are in authority over us. And so it says this in Proverbs 15, verse 28, the heart of the righteous studies to answer. The mouth of the wicked just pours out anything. Usually it ends up messy and evil. There's a story also related about President Woodrow Wilson. He went to a barber shop once, and there came in a man who was noted to be a very deeply religious man. Wilson said that he was immediately aware when this man entered the barber shop there. He said because every word that this man uttered, and those people who were serving him, every word he uttered seemed to be directed towards an interest in them and not in himself. He was not formal. He was not pompous in the way he dealt with others, although he was a well-known man. And the president, Wilson, said this about this individual who he met in a barbershop. Purposefully, I lingered until after he had left. And I noted the singular effect of his visit had on the barbers in that shop. Their conversation became quiet and subdued. Though they did not know his name, somehow his presence had elevated their thoughts and impressed them greatly. Personally, he said, I left there feeling I had been in a place of worship just because of one man entering this barbershop. Now, wouldn't this be the ideal if everywhere we went, in all of our conversation, that we were actually worshiping Christ in it? Well, I think this really is the heart of it. Are we saying what we say to please Christ or ourselves? So if we did this, it would be, I think, obvious to all, as it was regarding this man in the barbershop. So when we're threatened, however, on the other hand, with our faith, we don't need to be careful when we answer somebody. We need to know in advance. We're not going to disobey God, and we're not going to compromise. And so we don't need to argue about this. This is the way it goes, and that's the way it is. But outside, we need to be careful, too, that we don't give a wrong impression, that we do talk to people and work with people and cooperate with them as Christ himself would. So here is the answer these men gave to the furious king. Daniel 3, and verse 17 and 18. If it be so, they said, our God who we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. So Nebuchadnezzar had mistakenly believed that God could not deliver these people, and they were saying this: if you throw us in this fiery furnace, our God can deliver us from it. And he says, he will deliver us. I think this is interesting because it took me some time to think about this. He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. And so they believed that God would deliver them out of his hand, but they didn't necessarily believe that that meant they wouldn't die in the furnace. So I think what we're seeing here is the very first time, and we'll see other cases later, this is the first time the belief in the resurrection, I think, is intimated here. They understand that God would deliver them one way or another. He might save their lives from the furnace, but they might die there, and then God would raise them in a resurrection. Now, what these men next say to the king is, I think, the ultimate example of courage. But if not, they say, if God doesn't save us, it doesn't matter. We are not going to worship and serve your God. They were willing to face being burned to death in this case rather than betray God. They had come as far as they could in good conscience. They came to the plains of Dura. There they were. But when the music played, they said, no, I reject this. Their conscience wouldn't allow them to go further. They would obey God rather than men. To me, this is true devotion, that there are times when God delivers us. There are times when he just doesn't. The Apostle Paul wrote this. He said that there's no temptation that's fallen upon us that isn't common to man, but God will give us a way of escape. And some have thought this means that we'll always be delivered, but it doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't. Understand this. Paul valiantly faced trial after trial after trial. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians for a minute, 2 Corinthians 11. And he was not delivered from all of his trials, but instead he was delivered through his trials. And so he suffered for his faith. 2 Corinthians 11. A profound example of the faith of another great servant of God is found here, where he sort of explains what he went through for Christ's sake. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23 through 27, where Paul says, speaking of these other ministers that were attacking him, are they ministers of Christ? And then he says, I speak as a fool, I am more. In labors more abundant, in stripes more above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths often. Of the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. 3 times I was beaten with rods, and once I was stoned, and 3 times I suffered shipwreck. A night and day have I been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils by my own countrymen, and in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, and in perils among false brethren, in weariness, in painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, and fastings often, in cold and nakedness, and then besides those things that are without, those things that came on me daily, the care of all the churches, and so on. And so you understand the reason I read this is to remind us that, you know, we're not going to be delivered from every single trial in life. And we may have to face some things. It may not be a fiery furnace and the threat of death. But believe you me, God will test all of us. And I believe this was a test for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that was unique, and where Daniel was not in the mix in this case. And so if God's people were always protected, where would be the faith? Do you remember those people that followed Jesus Christ? And he fed the multitude, and he said, you don't seek me because of the truth. You are seeking me because of the fishes and the loaves. It's what you can get from me. And so God would just have a bunch of people out there that were just acting as fawning puppets, wouldn't he? If every time he blessed you for obedience. If every time it was you, whatever you want because you've obeyed me. No, he has to let us go through some trials and tribulations where we're not delivered, so he knows we believe in this way. We believe this is right, and we're going to be willing to suffer for it. It has to be. So we will, I think, have to prepare ourselves for future. And I'm saying this now to you, that this story is here for that reason, to prepare us for a future. And there are some parallels we'll see at the end of this study that I think are very unique, and that this story is there to prepare us for that. If you go back to Daniel 3 then, these people had completely surrendered their lives to God, and I think that's what we're going to have to do as well. Be willing to put our lives on the line in order to obey God. Now, what these men had done is they had already made the commitment in their mind that they would obey God. What they were doing now was just following through on that commitment they've already made. And we should then plan what we're going to do when a crisis comes and be able to say this, I'm not careful on how I'm going to deal with this. I choose God. I'm not going to be careful how I answer this question. It's God and it's God's way. This simply infuriated the king. Daniel 3 again, verse 19 through 23. Then was Nebuchadnezzar filled with fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they should heat the furnace one 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And then these men were bound in their coats, and their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Now this shows the absurdity of human rage, doesn't it? The king orders the furnace to be made 7 times hotter. And of course it was though these guys were clothed in asbestos or something, you know, like it would really make a difference. But you understand it even counteracts his own purpose here, because the hotter the furnace was, the more instant their death would be. There would be less suffering, so it's counterproductive. But anyway, the flames are so hot in this furnace now, the flames are leaping out of the top of the furnace and actually burn the individuals, the best guards he had, the best he had, he sends to bind these guys. He now kills them, a terrible waste of life. And then he ties these guys up all in their clothes, with their hats included, like this is going to really make sure that they burn all up, you know, around them. These flames will cover them. But it's just, it's amazing how human rage defies logic and wisdom sometimes, isn't it? Anyway, the ancient furnaces in those days were more like a sort of like a bottle, a milk bottle, where it would come up and narrow at the top, open at the top then to allow them to put, they would put big casks of ore up there and they could melt the ore. And they were made from a heat-resistant adobe brick and so on. And they would pipe in air from little holes in the bottom with these big bellows. And they would put the fuel in there, usually wood or coal or something. And anyway, that's where they cast these faithful worshipers of God. Daniel 3, verse 22. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace was exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, then fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished, and he rose up in haste, and he spoke and said unto his counselors, did not we cast 3 men bound in the midst of the fire? And they said unto the king, true, O king. And then he answered and he said, lo, I see 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the 4th is like the Son of God. The king is somewhat stunned here and dumbfounded and amazed by this. Looks into this furnace and he sees there's 4 men there. And he confers with the counselors, you know, am I seeing things or what? But now there's 4 men, and they're all loose from their bonds. And I'm thinking that they were tied with rope or something, and perhaps the fire burnt that rope off of them and left them untouched. But it could have been that they were bound with chains, actually, and they could have just fallen off just as easily as they did in the case of Paul when he was imprisoned and the angel came to him. But more shocking than all of this, I think, is that they were not hurt. The king could look into the furnace here. Here's the fire blazing. It's raging. The flames are leaping out and so on, licking out of the top. And it's hot enough to burn and melt actual bronze here. And now there's four men sort of milling around in there, you know, and they're talking and so on. One's talking with the other three. And he says that he looked like the Son of God. Now, some believe that this was Jesus Christ himself. And they think because the king knew that it was that there was a Messiah to come, perhaps, or maybe that the Holy Spirit had inspired him to say these things. But I'm going to suggest today that most of the evidence lends itself to this being an angel. The pagans were not familiar at all with the holy God, the true God. But they were aware of the concept of angels, who they thought were demigods or lesser gods on a lower level. They understood, too, that God was a family in a sense. That is, Baal was their godfather, and his wife's name was Melita, the mother. And the king was saying then, this is likely one of their children. So here's five reasons why I say an angel. The word Son of God is likely not referring to Christ for these reasons. The word in Chaldee is Elohim, which is very close to Elohim. It's the plural, and it just means it would be interpreted in their words, deities. Nebuchadnezzar was saying he looks like the son of the deities, that is, the father and mother God that they worship. Also, angels are called, what in the Bible? Sons of God. In verse 28, the king says, God sent an angel to deliver the men. In the case of Daniel, he later explains that God had sent an angel to close the mouth of the lions when he was in the lion's den. So if an angel came to save Daniel in the lion's den, it's likely that an angel came here to save these men. Now, I would suggest this, that it was Michael. Because remember, Michael came to him in another time and explains to him some he had been praying and fasting, wanting to know, well, when's the captivity going to be over and so on. And Michael actually comes to him and says, I would have come sooner, but I was in a conflict with the prince of Persia. And Michael is the warrior angel that is the one who intervenes and saves mankind. We generally see Gabriel in the Bible bringing messages from God. Michael we see with a sword in his hand. Michael is generally the one who is the one who delivers mankind and protects men. He is the angel of the Lord of hosts, a warrior angel. I have a personal theory about this I want to share with you, and as a member of this, it's my personal theory. But it's my belief this, that Michael protects God's people, and he's sent to deliver men from harm. When it's God's will, on the other hand, that men suffer, because sometimes that happens, then I think is when Christ himself comes. That is, he was there when Abraham had to kill his son Isaac. We see Christ there with him. When Paul, who suffered so much, he was able to see God in a vision in the third heaven, he says, you see. Remember Stephen, when he was being stoned? He was given a vision of Jesus Christ and God the Father. So it's my belief, over years of sort of studying, that when there is an intervention, that God will send Michael, an angel, and he will deliver mankind out of danger. But when it is time for us to give our all, Christ himself, I think, appears. And it's born a theory born out of hope. That is, if we should ever have to face giving our lives, as some have and been tortured even upon to die, that Jesus Christ appears to comfort us and strengthen us when we have to give our all. Because I see that example through the Bible. So that's just an idea I have, perhaps just a theory based on hope. But it does appear when men are delivered, it's by an angel, and when we face the loss of all, that Christ seems to come and comfort them. Anyway, now the king calls these men forth, and they come out, but the fourth one disappears. Daniel 3, verse 26 and 27. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and he spoke and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth and come here. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth in the midst of the fire, and the princes and the governors and the captains and the king's counselors being gathered together saw these men upon whom the bodies, the fire, had no power, nor was the hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Now this to me is a testimony of God's power. It just has to be. You understand, this is a supernatural God. He didn't just save their lives. None of their clothing is singed. There, not a hair was curled on their head from that fire. And there wasn't even the smell. A stunning defeat for the Chaldean gods. They worship the sun. And they worship fire because they believe fire came from the sun. And now here, their god that they worship has absolutely no power over the god of these Jewish men. The victory was fivefold. They were loosed from their bonds. They were protected from any hurt or harm. They were comforted by the being that was down there talking to them at the time that they were there. And their god was exalted above all the other gods. And now finally, they're rewarded. And with this kind of a display of God's power, Nebuchadnezzar's ego is now deflated. And he says, remember he said, what God is there that can deliver you? Now he knew. That God, he knew his name. His name was Yahweh. He had the power to deliver men. And now the king speaks in chapter 3, verse 28 and 29. Then Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. And so now he praises God. Once seeking to destroy these three men, he now honors these three men, and he praises them for trusting their God. They were steadfast in their devotion and their obedience to God. You know, there's a lot of religious men in this world, aren't there? You see them on television, you see them every day, and you hear them on street corners, and they're all preaching. They're religious men. But how many continue to be religious men when they are faced with having to lose? How many will do that? How many stick? A lot of starters, but few stickers, really. And it's an example for us. We should be this kind of steadfast in even the face of death. This is our aim. But I want to remind us that God's servants haven't always been perfectly steadfast. There's Abraham, as you remember, lied, didn't he? Lied about his wife. Said that she was his sister. Why did he do that? To avoid any harm to himself. You know, a little selfish there, not thinking about her. Jonah did the exact opposite of what God said to do. And the reason he did that, by the way, it wasn't just to save his own skin. He did not want to go to Nineveh, which was the capital of Assyria, and get them to repent, because he knew of Isaiah's prophecies that Assyria was going to be used to destroy his people. That's why he didn't want to go warn them. It wasn't just selfish motives. I don't want you to think that. Anyway, the point I'm making here is that many times David, for instance, failed God greatly, the God he loved so much. He let him down. So I say this for this reason. You or I may not have exhibited the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego so far. Maybe we've made mistakes. Maybe we've had failures and so on. And I want to remind us, all of God's servants are going to come eventually to this point. And that's the point of even the mistakes we've made. Don't let them discourage you if you failed God or made a mistake or something and not had this kind of faith. Don't get depressed over it, but rather use that as a point of refinement, a point of change, and a point to go on. Because we are going to make mistakes, and God's servants have made mistakes. And this is a wonderful example to us. But you understand, some can get very discouraged when they compare our faith to these men's faith. And these were unique and great servants of God. But even other great servants of God have made mistakes. Don't let it discourage you, but use it as a means to catapult us further on. That is, failure is just what? It's just a red light saying, hey, mistake, mistake, mistake. So you make a turn, you change, and you learn from that lesson. You say, that's it, I don't do this again. And now we go forward until we get to the point where we are like these men, where we don't consider, we don't argue the point, we don't hesitate, we obey God in every case. And this is our end. and this is what we want to learn to be an example from their example. We want to learn from that. Anyway, now Nebuchadnezzar makes a proclamation and a decree. No person in the empire can say anything against this God. This is ironic, isn't it? The people of God fail in their faithfulness. They have been crushed by the pagan armies and by seemingly the god of Babylon. They've been crushed by this, and it appears from all outside that God has failed. Yahweh appears weak, powerless against these other gods. Now it's made clear to everyone, God is God. The greatest power on the face of the earth, Nebuchadnezzar, acknowledges God is the greatest God, a God of gods. Now, he wasn't convinced yet that he is the only God. This will come later. There are stages in Nebuchadnezzar's understanding that goes on here. Let's go to Jeremiah 2, if you will. He was convinced that God was greater than all the other gods, and so he tells them that this God is the God who can deliver men. No one's allowed to say anything against him. So God gets respect from a pagan king, and he gets respect from a pagan people instead of his own people. This is the irony of it all. God's people have God. They have the truth, and yet they take it for granted, and they leave off the worship of God Almighty, and that we tend to turn to worship things that aren't God. Jeremiah 2 brings this out. Jeremiah 2 and verse 10 and 11 says this. God says, pass over the isles of Shittim and see, and send unto Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. And so you understand what he's saying here. Look, you go around all these pagan nations. Go from here to the islands. Go anywhere. These people, the pagans, they're loyal to their gods. They serve their gods. But my people take me for granted, and then they leave off and worship that which profits nothing. Man, that occurs today, too. And we just witnessed this in the Worldwide Church of God. They're people that know the truth, and they will leave that truth and leave God's law, and they will reject the glory of God for empty vanity. Now, why do they do this? Why do they do this? There is a reason, and that reason is this. The true God requires something of us. He requires that we be moral, and he requires that we be ethical. You understand, the false gods require sacrifices that are not dear to us, but God requires the sacrifice of what it is we are. He requires that we go against our human nature. What about the false gods? Oh no, they embrace human nature. In fact, the false gods exhibit human nature, don't they? Yes, because they're made in man's image, you see. So for this reason, men will reject the true God and follow false gods, because it's so much easier to do, and it just fits with our human nature and so on. Anyway, those people who will follow the true God will always be blessed. And so God gives to these men who have followed him and been loyal tremendous blessing here. Back to Daniel 3. Daniel 3 and verse 30. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. And so the king promoted them. There's an awesome lesson, if you go to Psalm 75, in all of this. So many times in business today, you'll see the politics going on. You'll see that if you do a good job, people will go after you. They'll try to discredit you. They'll try to get you, as it were, stab you in the back. And sometimes it's a temptation for us to try to protect ourselves. Sometimes we want to try to outfox the others, try to beat them at their own game, so to speak, you might say. My point today is, the lesson here is, don't. We don't have to do this. All we have to do is just obey God, faithfully obey God. If we start trying to play their game, what'll happen? We'll become like they are, and that's going to cheapen us. But if we will just simply obey God, we will find ourselves doing what? Getting promoted. because the promotion doesn't really come from our boss. It doesn't really come, even if you'll let me say this, from our own competence and the good job you might do. That may help some, you understand. But it still doesn't come from that. Where does it come from? Psalm 75, verse 6. Promotion comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge, and he puts one down, and he sets up another. Promotion comes from God. So we can trust God to deliver us from our trials and be the one that promotes us. But if he doesn't, you understand the lesson? That's okay too. He'll raise us up and use us in his kingdom. We'll be part of that palace in the New Jerusalem one day. We'll be his officers. We'll be his rulers then. It's interesting to note that all through history, dictators have always attempted to do this, force people to worship their gods. Assyria did this before Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar was now doing it here. Other nations today still do this. In China, they did it, didn't they? Remember in Russia? It was the same way for years. It's only recently Russia has allowed anyone to go to church or to have a religion and, out in the open. And so in the Muslim nations, isn't it that way right now? Oh, yes, it is. They all require you to worship their way and their gods, and they'll use politics and military to do this, and I say this for this reason. Like the dream, this story came from God to show us something about the future. There is coming an incredible reenactment of this story. It pictures the final Babylon at the end of the age. And the future Babylon is going to require what? That you worship an image, isn't it? Let's go over to Revelation 13. That final beast, that final king tyrant in the modern end time Babylon is going to require some very unique and, I think, things paralleling what we have just read. Go through a couple scriptures here and then we'll end. Revelation 13, 11 through 17. And I beheld and another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke as a dragon, and he exercised all the power of the first beast before him and caused the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he did great wonders, so that he made fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceived them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So it begins to sound a little bit similar. And he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And so let's go over to Revelation 14, where this is discussed just a little bit more, verse 9 and 10. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And so it is. The smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. The saints are going to be required to resist worshiping an image at the end of the age. They're going to have to put their lives on the line. If we live in that time, this will be us. And it is, I think, an important lesson. The faithful are going to be saved either directly in a place of safety or indirectly. That is, they will die and be raised in a resurrection. We're going to have to face the very same thing that these three men faced. In the account of Daniel, those who took up the men to the fiery furnace, they were burned by that fiery furnace and died. In the end time scenario, those who go against God and force others to accept the mark of the beast and force others to worship the image of the beast, they are going to, in fact, be killed by what? By the fire and brimstone that comes down. So I say this, as we enter the end of the age, we who live in that time, remember this story and remember it in hope. And remember these famous words. Our God can save us. He will deliver us from this evil king. If not now, know this, we will not bow down to you, and be predisposed and have it set in our mind. That's how we'll answer.